The Spectator magazine is home to wonderful writing, insightful analysis, and unrivaled books and arts reviews. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online, along with a free £20 John Lewis or Waitrose voucher. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to the Edition podcast from The Spectator, where each week we shed a little light into the thought process behind putting the world's oldest weekly magazine to bed. I'm William Moore, The Spectator's features editor.
And I'm Laura Prendergast, The Spectator's executive editor.
On this week's episode, will Washington support Ukraine's attacks on Russian soil? Who's the bigger threat to democracy, Trump or Biden? And how will the Voyager 1 probe be remembered?
So, Will, this week's cover is Owen Matthews. He's looking at how long America can continue to support Zelensky's long-range missile campaign. As he points out, there's always been this red line that America is unwilling to cross, which is directly supporting Ukrainian attacks on Russian soil. But as he points out, that's now being tested because of Zelensky's very successful strategy at the moment of targeting sort of oil refineries and certain parts of Russia's key infrastructure.
Yes, and those drone strikes are becoming more effective. So it is becoming more of a problem for Ukraine's allies. And Owen joined us earlier to talk about the piece, along with Svetlana Mornets, author of The Spectator's Ukraine in Focus newsletter. We started by asking Owen to give us an update on the state of the war as it is now.
Well, the problem is that the story of the last 2 years of the war has been really one of too little, too late in terms of significant aid. I mean, looking back, we can identify a couple of moments when Ukraine, you know, could have actually brought the conflict to an end. For instance, in the aftermath of their last major success, territorial success, which is when they threw the Russians out of Kherson town and parts of Kharkiv back in October of 22. But since then, the Russian steamroller has just kind of ground ahead, and town after town has fallen, unfortunately, to the Russians. And what's, you know, the current political deadlock in Washington has, of course, just worsened that situation. And we've been hearing for months reports from the front line of artillery shortages, of Ukrainians, you know, fighting and losing just because they haven't been adequately supported by Western military aid. There's another question that, quite apart from the political one in Washington, and that is just in terms of supplying this materiel. Factory Raytheon that makes Patriot missile batteries say they can only produce one per month. The Western European allies, NATO members, are running out of shells to send to the Ukrainians and so on. So, you know, across the board, before we even get to the discussion of like the biggest point and the biggest inflection point of the last few weeks, is a massive escalation of, you know, long-range missile attacks by Russia on Ukrainian targets and of long-range drone attacks by Ukraine on Russian targets. But even without that, you know, Ukraine is slowly but steadily losing the war on the ground. And the proximate cause for that is just a lack of military supplies to keep that defensive machine running.
And Svetlana, so Owen mentioned just then the Ukrainian drone attacks on Russian soil, and he says in the piece that these are daily attacks and they're getting bolder and more sophisticated. You wrote an excellent piece for the magazine last year about the Army of Drones program in Ukraine. So I wondered if you could tell our listeners a little bit about what Ukraine's strategy is with these drone attacks on Russia.
Yes, of course. When I was writing that piece last year, I talked to the Mikhail Fodorov. He is like the Minister of Digital Transformation, but also he is chief of the drones army in Ukraine. And back then, I remember he told me that they were developing drones that could fly up to 600-700 miles. And finally, like last week, he said that they already did it, and we could notice that by Russian drone factories far inside of Russia being hit by Ukrainian strikes. So right now there are a lot of private companies in Ukraine that make drones, and they assign contracts with our defense ministry, and they supply by the army directly and defense ministry is paying them. So it's, I would say it's the most successful Ukrainian strategy so far. It's the only way that how Ukraine can make war painful for Russia. They can really feel the consequences of it. It's not only about like shelling their factories and oil refineries, but also bringing war like to Russian people and making them see what is happening and hoping that they will wake up, you know.
And what do you make of Owen's point, which is the kind of main thrust of the cover piece, that the success and the frequency of these assaults inside Russia is starting to draw some criticism from allies, most notably America. What do you make of that point?
It feels very unfair because currently it's the only way that we can fight the war because we don't have enough artillery weapons on the front line. We can't do anything on the ground. We are losing on the ground. Russians are advancing. Like yesterday, they captured Pervomaiske village and they keep moving forward. So for us, it's the only chance how to fight Russia back. And when you are being attacked by an aggressor, you have complete right to strike back. That's why it feels like ridiculous, those claims that we shouldn't do that because oil prices can rise before the elections. Like in what world are we living?
Yeah, no, and what do you make of that Ukraine obviously has a right to be able to fight back against Russia and America should be supporting that. What do you make of that point?
Well, the really shocking thing about the recent developments is, we all know the sort of sad story of the US Republican Party sort of descending into opposition to aid to Ukraine, which is, you know, clear break from the sort of the very robust attitude that Republicans traditionally took, for instance, you know, in the 80s under Reagan about opposing communism. That's all completely disappeared. The Republicans are more and more opposed to military aid to Ukraine. But the shocking thing is, you know, we're now seeing the Biden administration, which has been the big cheerleader for aid to Ukraine. They spent a huge amount of political capital over the last 2 years pushing that through. And now you have Antony Blinken, the Secretary of State, saying that, you know, we don't support and we don't facilitate the Ukrainian strikes inside Russia. That's, you know, still a long way from actual condemnation of those Ukrainian strikes. So, you know, we're not hearing that it's bad and wrong from the Americans, but nonetheless, it's an important and kind of worrying political signal. And unfortunately, I think that, as Svetlana mentioned, I think the major cause is just, you know, U.S. domestic politics. The Biden administration doesn't want an oil price spike in the run-up to what promises to be a very close election. They definitely don't want a major escalation. They don't want a direct confrontation between NATO and Russia in the run-up to the election. So, unfortunately, it's a sad story that actually the U.S., even the Biden administration, which was so sound and so uncompromising at the beginning of the war in supporting Ukraine, has now started to dial back on that commitment.
Hmm. And you mentioned in your piece that there's a kind of slight change in approach when it comes to Blinken. You also mentioned Jake Sullivan, U.S. National Security Advisor, and his growing caution. I mean, do you think this is something which is this tension between the US and Ukraine over drone strikes? Do you think that's going to exacerbate if these strikes?
I think the US is not going to put serious pressure on the Ukrainians to stop and cease and desist. The fact that Blinken made that official statement publicly was actually as much a signal to Russia to indicate that, you know, this is not the US directly attacking Russia, it's the Ukrainians. Let's be clear about that. So, you know, it's about signaling to the Kremlin too. The real question about these deep strikes is the extent to which they will actually ultimately be able to cripple the Russian war machine, cripple the Russian economy, and convince Russians that the war is coming home to them. I mean, so far, the scale has been much bigger than it has been in previous years. About half of the refineries in oil refineries in Russia have been hit. About an estimated 10 to 14% of Russian oil refinery capacity has been damaged so far. And oil prices at the pumps have gone up. And furthermore, you have restrictions on the export of gasoline products. So, you know, clearly they're having an effect. And there's also been strikes on the Shahed drone factory in Tatarstan, and lots of military airfields and so on. So, I mean, it's not negligible, but at this scale, it's not really anything close to crippling the Russian war machine, and it's not really anything close to actually seriously at this point damaging Putin's political reputation. And to your question about Jake Sullivan, so there have been several Washington insiders who claim that the White House, particularly Sullivan himself, is nervous that an escalation may, you know, that these deep strikes inside Russia may be the prelude to an escalation, possibly a nuclear escalation. I think that's, frankly, still very unlikely. But on the other hand, it's not a totally crazy fear, because I think what we've seen, and particularly in the aftermath of the Crocus City Hall attacks, when 144 Russians were killed last month by ISIS gunmen, you have the entire political establishment of Russia and the security establishment coming out and frankly saying, not only we blame Ukraine, but actually we blame the United States and we blame, you know, the collective West for organizing this terror attack. And actually, that's a very terrifying thing, if they actually really believe that, believe their own propaganda. It's not the first time we've seen irrational behavior and ill-informed behavior from Putin and his inner circle. But this is like a new level of cray-cray that we just never experienced, that actually they really think that, you know, Washington got together and, you know, with ISIS and planned to kill Russian civilians in the center of Moscow. I mean, that is very disturbing news about the sort of febrile atmosphere in the Kremlin. And, you know, I think it's, it's definitely, you know, a cause for concern.
And Svetlana, just finally, can you take us through a little bit about what's going on in Ukraine right now? There's the decision to lower the age of conscription, which you reported on for The Spectator, and that, as Owen says in his piece, is causing some political unrest in Ukraine. There's also talk about a possible Russia offensive this summer. So could you also talk a little bit about that?
Yes, of course, the conscription bill is the main topic in Ukraine right now, and it's likely that this week it's finally going to be voted in the second reading in the parliament. They have been dragging the decision for months, and only when Zelensky and our allies said, okay, you have to do it because we lack men on the front line, we need reinforcements, they're going to do it. It's also because there were like over 4,000 amendments to the bill, and they have to check every month, so it took a long time. And there is a bit scandal that they deleted from the bill a sentence that soldiers who served for 3 months, who were fighting for 3 years, I'm sorry, they can go home and be free from their service, but they just deleted it from the bill and said, okay, we are gonna put it in another bill. And soldiers don't believe that, you know. Many feel that if you join the army, you will be fighting till the end there, or till the end of the war, or till you are dead or injured heavily, so you can stay on the front line anymore. And about Russian summer offensive, Zelensky repeatedly said that with the current amount of weapons that we have, Russians are going to have a breakthrough and we are going to start losing lands. And also, we don't have enough air defense systems. And right now, Kharkiv, Ukraine's second largest city, is suffering a lot from Russian attacks. It looks like Russians want just to wipe out the city and then try to take over it, as they did with Bakhmut or Avdiivka, for example. And like 2 weeks ago, they launched a large missile attack and they destroyed every power grid, power station in the city, leaving like over 200,000 people without electricity. So there are fears that Kharkiv will be their primary target, but the Ukrainian government denies it. But still, they were building fortifications along the front line in like Donetsk and Luhansk regions, especially because I think the main goal will be, for Russians, the main goal will be to capture Donetsk and Luhansk regions completely, what they couldn't do in 2014.
Svetlana and Owen, thank you very much indeed for joining us. Thank you.
Will, what else did you enjoy in the issue this week?
Well, lots of things. What I'd particularly like to draw attention to is a very fun piece by Rachel Johnson on the subject that's been rumbling away for a few weeks now, the very contentious subject of the Garrick and men-only clubs. And her argument, which hasn't, I think, quite been articulated yet, is that the main problem she has with the argument for male-only clubs is that the supposed alternative, women-only clubs, she says just don't work. And her reasons for this, she can explain herself, because we're going to hear a little extract from her piece now.
Nobody gives up power lightly. I can see why penis owners of a certain vintage cherish their comfortable place in town where they can read the Daily Telegraph in a wing-backed leather armchair, entertain a friend over Dover Sole, or gulp a glass of Sancerre before the theatre. The fact that these clubs are full of powerful and important men, apparently, is not my main objection to them either. The membership lists may well be a roll call of the establishment. Don't care. No, my objection is to the supposed alternative. Women-only clubs. They'll never catch on. Lynn Franks set up 3 Beehive women-only business networking spaces in Covent Garden, Manchester and Bristol in 2010, but they folded. La Franks has a new project called Seed Hub in Wincanton, which the legendary PR says will be a nurturing place for women to come to be recharged and inspired, and nothing like the classic club where men fall asleep with cigars in their mouths. The women-only club chief in Bloomsbury, membership costing up to £7,900 per annum, closed last month. After taking a critical look at where we need to strategically focus, we've made the extremely difficult decision to exit the UK market, said one of the American co-founders. Another American women-only club, The Wing in Fitzrovia, folded after less than a year in 2020. The Albright Club tagline, "Invest in ambition," is still active and promotes itself as a space where women can thrive professionally. Funny that. Women-only clubs are all marketed as networking hubs, while men-only clubs are effortlessly social and superior. They're not glorified WeWork spaces. No part of the clubhouse may be used for business purposes, which includes discussing business matters, as it says on the Garrick's website. And that surely tells us all we need to know. Men want to carry on with their cosy clubland in gentlemen's London, as they always have, while we busy bees can have our networking hubs. No thanks.
How about you, Laura? What did you enjoy?
Well, I really enjoyed Cosmo Landesman's Life column this week. It made me laugh. He talks about why he never manages to top up his ISA, which sounds quite a sort of dry subject, but he says the problem is he's now become a man of very modest means, getting near to the state of being a freeloader. But he also says the worst thing about his state of genteel poverty is that it's actually disastrous for his sex life.
What I like about it is I think that Cosmo points out correctly that boomers, and he's a boomer himself, boomers nowadays get a lot of attacks from people in the media. You know, they're the generation that supposedly had it all. And Cosmo, despite being a boomer, has pretty much nothing, as he would put it. Mm. And he squandered all the money that he briefly had. So he's a sort of example of a broke boomer, which he acknowledges is a hard group to feel sorry for.
I also enjoyed Angus's notes on wild garlic. Well, I think you are a fan of wild garlic foraging, aren't you? And perhaps you are the person or one of the people that Angus is talking about, because he says that it's become very fashionable amongst young people.
Oh, no, but Laura, he says it's fashionable for young urban...
Well, in which case, I'm not quite who he's talking about, but he says that the kind of Instagram lot are all obsessed with wild garlic. But he makes an interesting point that partly he thinks wild garlic's appeal lies in its impermanence and that you can't get it all year round. And nowadays, there's probably sort of, some kind of luxury in being able to not get something all year round, I suppose.
Yes, I think there's definitely truth to that. The second piece we're going to talk about in a bit more detail is Lionel Shriver's column. She writes this week that when more than two-thirds of the American electorate doesn't want to vote for either major party's nominee, then a third party should have a chance. And as for which of the two candidates of the main parties is more of a threat to democracy, she says that she declares that a dead heat. So what's left for American voters? She joined us to discuss. Lionel, you start by writing about this position where the American public has ended up in, whereby a large portion of the American public seems to hate either the Democratic or the Republican candidate. So how has this come about, and why hasn't this given way for the emergence of a tenable third candidate or party?
It's mystifying, honestly. I can't think of a better election to upset, because it's upsetting so many people. And yeah, it's two-thirds of the electorate does not want either one of these candidates. And it has been demonstrated repeatedly in polls that whichever party chucked its front runner and ran anyone else, anyone, not even named, they would win. And yet nobody has chucked the front runner. This has given rise to what's called the No Labels movement. Is an organization that mobilized to try to put together a unity ticket so that you could find, you know, a combination of a president and a vice president that would somehow unite all these people who are disaffected and want a different choice. And it was a good idea, aside from the fact that we are dealing with a ferociously polarized polity right now. And how would you come up with the compromise? It is a polity where compromise is anathema. And there are a lot of big issues on the line which don't really admit easily to compromise. I mean, you're either going to be funding Ukraine or you're going to withdraw the funding. In fact, the middle course in some ways is the worst, because then you give them just enough money to keep fighting and dying, but not enough money to win. So unsurprisingly, I suppose, No Labels folded up shop and is no longer trying, because they could not find a prominent politician anywhere in either party who was willing to take a risk outside their own party. I think that would be endangering your career, because, you know, No Labels might disappear and then you're stuck with having been a traitor to your own cause and possibly being in exile. But the whole story is so frustrating, because, you know, I am among the two-thirds of people who doesn't want to vote for either of these people, and we seem to be stuck with them, aside from RFK.
Yes, well, can we talk about RFK? Because obviously, historically speaking, there's often been quite prominent sometimes third-party candidates in U.S. presidential elections, and yet, famously, they never managed to really have a shot at it, and the best they can hope is to disrupt the campaign of one of the other two main parties. So is that what we're going to see again with RFK? And if so, who do you think he will hurt more, Biden or Trump?
I think the Democrats are much more frightened of him than the Republicans are frightened of RFK. But the truth is that, at least according to the New York Times, which has the motivation to be stirring up anxiety, RFK Jr. is drawing pretty much equally from both Republicans and Democrats. So it's really up for grabs which direction that would head. You know, it's interesting to me that RFK Jr. himself is not particularly fussed about which party he hurts more, because he doesn't care which one of them wins. And that's where we rounded on my main point, was that this is a contest of negatives. And as I look at it, at the next 4 years, under either one of them, both scenarios are incredibly depressing, just for different reasons.
Yeah. Well, you say that in your piece. You say that both sides like to claim that the other's a threat to democracy in this rather depressing environment. What's your conclusion? Which one do you think is a bigger threat to democracy? Or is it too close to call?
I did declare it a dead heat, off the record or sort of on the record. I'm a little more afraid of Biden, or more particularly the people behind Biden. because they are lit with the fires of self-righteousness. And the Democrats have given every indication that they will do anything to keep Trump from being reelected. Anything. And they don't care how much they bend the rules, because they have God on their side in their little secular way. I am more afraid of people who are that certain that they are right and therefore do not care about the means to their perfect ends. Whereas the one thing that makes Trump less threatening to me is his short attention span, his disinterest in detail. He's lazy. He tends to break rules partly because he doesn't even know what the rules are. And you know, he has all kinds of grand plans that, you know, starting what are essentially concentration camps for immigrants. First off, that kind of stuff will get thrown out by the courts. And secondly, it would take a mammoth amount of energy to push something through like that. And I just don't think he's got it in him. What makes him tick is wanting to win and then wanting to be admired. And without another election pending, I think that will take the wind out of his sails a little bit. He'll ponce around and he'll try to put through a few things, some of which I might even agree with. But I just don't think he has the mind of a Machiavellian. He's, you know, he's crude and he's full of bluster and he talks a big game. But to completely subvert American democracy, you have to be rather sly. And you see, I think the Democrats are slyer. What they have done to Trump, and, you know, I'm not a Trumpster. I have never voted for him. Just let's get that straight. But the Democrats have made even me feel a little sorry for him. I understand that emotional reaction to somebody who's getting kicked around. I mean, all of these cases in the courts, it's a concerted effort. Some of them are ridiculous. They involve massive amounts of money that would never pertain to anybody but Donald Trump. And it looks bad, you know? It looks genuinely undemocratic. It looks third world. It looks banana republic, you know? And yet, because it's to get Trump, the Democrats think that this is completely kosher. And that gives me chills.
Despite this great unsatisfaction that you mentioned at the very beginning of your piece in these two candidates, the fact still remains that I think for most people coming to November, they will think third-party candidates don't have much of a shot of actually winning. You do eventually have to make a choice for one or the other, even if that's a choice made negatively. So if you don't mind me asking, Lionel, when it comes to November and it's time for you to vote, do you know what you're going to do yet? Last time around, you wrote a very good column for The Spectator about why you were a reluctant Biden voter. But it sounds to me from what you've just said that you're rather more down on him, or at least his administration, now than you were in 2020.
Of course I am. It's not just the Trump and the courts. It's also Biden and co. in relation to free speech and their interest and pursuit of aggressive censorship through the social media companies. And because it's to keep people from saying wrong things. Yeah, it always is, isn't it? So since he's been in office, he's really alienated me. I bought the line that he was a centrist. Yeah. And instead, as soon as he gets into office, it's aggressive affirmative action, you know, what are essentially racial preferences. And then in through COVID, he tried to put in racial preferences for vaccines and for business funding. You know, blacks were supposed to get special treatment and, you know, get the vaccines first, which I'm not sure would have actually been doing them any favors, but that's another issue. You know, he's been quite high-handed and extremely left wing. Now, to come back to your awkward question, which I am obviously.
What are you going to do?
Well, I'll tell you what, I'm going to cheat.
Oh.
Okay. Because I'm registered in New York State. And therefore, it doesn't really matter for whom I vote. So I will probably vote for RFK Jr., who I think is a flawed candidate also, but among other flawed candidates, who cares? And he's not going to be president. So I can just lodge my protest vote without taking any consequences. If I were in a swing state, I would not be able to afford that kind of purity, right? Yeah. I would need to get my hands dirty with one candidate or the other. I still don't know what I would do in that circumstance. I feel badly about that because I just cannot envision myself voting for Trump. I can't. And I wonder if I would be one of those people who ends up staying home. And I have contempt for that. You can tell I go round and round.
Yes. Well, I'm sure there's millions of Americans who think through these exact same lines of argument.
This is what's happening to more than half the country of this churn. And I supported DeSantis on the Republican side for early on because I thought that he was he was another flawed candidate. I certainly don't agree with him on abortion, but at least he was not Trump. He was not erratic in that fashion, and he was pushing back against the progressive agenda, a lot of which I object to. But it didn't work. You know, nothing worked with either party. I think the Democrats never seriously allowed anyone to compete with Biden, including RFK Jr., who did make a bid to at least give Biden a little competition in the primaries, and they managed to shut him out.
As my colleague Freddie Gray put it, it's the Trump versus Biden 2024 is the rematch that everyone expected and no one wanted.
Exactly.
And here we are. Lionel, thank you so much indeed for joining me. Laura, just before we get on to our final topic, I would like to draw attention to a poem, because each week we do have some lovely poems which pepper the pages of the magazine. And there's an extremely nice one went alongside Owen's cover piece, actually, by Ben Wilkinson. It's called Dog Years, and we're going to hear it now read by The Spectator's special projects editor, Ben Lazarus, himself a very keen dog lover.
Dog Years by Ben Wilkinson. Instead of scattering your ashes, let's go for another walk across those swaying fields you'll sprint half the length of, sun low as I dawdle your lead, watch you weaving through waist-high grasses, time blurring as wind whittles away at gritstone edge. You'll sniff your way up the scree, village blinking below like so much loose change, the ledge gifting a perspective that the hard-edged look of things might resolve to melt away. Your single bark now echoing a pledge to live as dogs will, in this moment, this day. So much for memory. Below this ancient shelf, you're still running, still scattering yourself.
And finally, on to the subject of space. David Whitehouse, in this week's issue, says that sometime soon, we're going to have to say farewell to our most distant emissary, the Voyager 1 spacecraft. After almost 50 years in space, it's 15 billion miles away and starting to show signs of wear and tear, which seems sort of fair enough, really. But it does mean that it could soon stop transmitting. David joined us earlier, along with Professor Sasha Hinckley, an astrophysicist from the University of Exeter. David, in the magazine this week, you write about Voyager 1, which you say could soon stop transmitting back to Earth. Could you start by taking listeners through the history of this space probe and what it achieved, really?
It's a remarkable probe, a pair of two probes, Voyagers 1 and Voyagers 2. And it was in the early 1970s that it was realised that there was a unique alignment, or a very rare alignment, every 180 years or so, of the outer planets. So that you could send one space probe to Jupiter and then on to Saturn and then on to Uranus and Neptune. And you didn't have to send individual probes to the individual planets. You could do a grand tour. And so the idea of doing this with two Voyagers, two in case one of them broke down, in the 1970s, and they were launched in 1977, and their scientific harvest Jupiter, Saturn, the moons of Jupiter, and a particularly interesting moon of Saturn called Titan, was just extraordinary. This is one of the most dramatic and productive space missions ever achieved. It really did change our view of the solar system. But because it's going on that journey, it was realized that it was leaving the solar system completely, and therefore symbolically on its side, there should be a message from its makers, from the people who made it, from all of us.
And can you tell us a bit about that message?
Well, how do you, I mean, you may have suggestions, how do you design a message from planet Earth? I mean, it is almost impossible to think of the breadth of what humanity is, what the Earth is, and try and express it in just over 100 pictures, in about 50 sounds and a handful of messages. How do you pick the pictures? They did a remarkable job. This was Carl Sagan and his wife, and soon to be wife, Anne Druyan, and a few others. Part of it was the list they approached experts and said, what music would you send? What pictures would you send? What ancient languages would you send to somehow represent us? Some of the time, actually, though, their choice was dictated by what was available. I mean, there's a famous story that they wanted Here Comes the Sun by the Beatles to appear on this disc. And evidently, Carl Sagan says the Beatles were all for it, but they didn't own the copyright. That went to EMI. And EMI said yes, provided the fee is $50,000. Now, they didn't have that. They only had a budget of, I think, $18,000. So because of that, you've got Chuck Berry, you've got Beethoven, you've got Bach, you've got all sorts of music from all over the world, but you don't have any Beatles.
I quite like the idea that they might be protecting Here Comes the Sun from being ripped off by alien life somewhere.
That's right. They said it was a copyright problem. Well, copyright by whom?
Yeah.
Out there in deep space.
Yes. You know,
it was a ridiculous... I think actually it was probably incompetent. It was a knee-jerk reaction. And they quoted a high figure to make them go away. And they didn't really quite understand what it entails.
Sasha, I'd love to bring you into this conversation. So for listeners who aren't aware, you've done work with the James Webb Telescope, which you've written about a little bit before for The Spectator. I'd love to get your opinion, not just on what Voyager 1 has achieved in terms of our knowledge about space, but I wondered, in the 50-year period when it's been traveling through the cosmos, what are some of the big leaps forward we've had in our general understanding of space in that time?
So that's a great question. I mean, maybe I could start by commenting on what, to me, I think is one of the most important contributions of Voyager 1. And to me, that was the image of the pale blue dot that is our own Earth. So Carl Sagan and others had this idea that as Voyager 1 was leaving our solar system, that would be a remarkable opportunity to actually turn the spacecraft around and look back at our own solar system and do kind of a family portrait of all of the planets in our solar system, which was just an amazing image, if you will. And so they were able to actually do a patchwork of images covering all the planets across the solar system. And one of the most amazing images is that of our own Earth. The image itself is not that amazing because all we see is the tiniest little white speck. And for the listeners out there, it would pay to just have a quick Google. Google pale blue dot, Carl Sagan. You'll quickly see the Voyager 1 image. And this really inspired Carl and others to really think about our own Earth in the sort of grand scheme of the cosmos. And it actually inspired him to write his book, Pale Blue Dot. And so actually, I think that has been a huge inspiration for my work and the work that I've been doing with the James Webb Space Telescope, where we're actually trying to take images of extrasolar planets, that is, planets around other stars. Because I think there's something incredibly powerful, not only to the public, but also to the scientific community about capturing the image of a planet and whether that planet is our own Earth or planets orbiting other suns. And if we have time, I'd love to read just a couple of sentences that Carl Sagan wrote about this pale blue dot, if we have time.
Yes, please do. Yeah.
What Carl Sagan wrote in his text is he said, "Look at that dot. That's here. That's home. That's us. On it, everyone you love, everyone you know, everyone you ever heard of, every human being who ever was, lived out their lives. that the aggregate of our joy and suffering, thousands of confident religions, ideologies, and economic doctrines, every hunter and forager, every hero and coward, every creator and destroyer of civilization, every king and peasant, every young couple in love, every mother and father, every superstar, every supreme leader, every saint and sinner in the history of our species lived there on a mote of dust suspended in a sunbeam. And I think that kind of encapsulates the sort of fragility of our own Earth, but really the sort of smallness of our own existence. It's very easy to think that we're the center of the universe, but that image really reminded us that we are not.
Do you know, there was a poet once who wrote that the universe is not made of atoms or molecules or stars or planets or galaxies. She said it was made of stories, which is an interesting idea. And when I see Sasha's pictures from the James Webb Space Telescope, particularly those huge vizzes of distant galaxies, you see the stars, you see the galaxies, but we wonder, in the spirit of Voyager and the spirit of Carl Sagan, what stories are there out there? As Carl said, he pointed towards the pale blue dot and said, that's us. Every battle, every victory, every sorrow, every joy on that dot. But when we see these huge, wide fields of galaxies, we wonder what other people's, what other beings' stories, galaxies, battles, what great events are taking out there. And it is remarkable that from a pale blue dot and from the James Webb Space Telescope, it brings us to ask these wonderful, big questions. You know, Voyager's going off into the distance with our message from us. We could pick up a message from aliens tomorrow, and that would certainly focus our minds as to where we are in the universe and what how we relate to them.
Relating to the golden disk, I mean, as you say, clearly that's there in case Voyager 1 does come across some other form of life. In the 50 years that it's been travelling, do you think we've come any closer to sort of understanding whether such life might exist out there?
Yes and no. I mean, we certainly understand life better. Life is a complex, multi-layered phenomenon. It is difficult to point to any one thing and say that is what life is all about. It seems to be a collaboration across all types of scales and all types of events that produce us and the life on planet Earth. But we have no evidence, and I'm sure Sasha would agree, we have no evidence anywhere, despite what some people say, with no evidence of life elsewhere in the universe. We search for it. We hope in the sands of Mars there may be evidence of past life that started but then stalled because Mars became inhospitable. The sub-ice oceans of some of the moons of Jupiter and Saturn that Voyager showed us so clearly might be suitable environments for the start of life, but we have no evidence. But Voyager's unlikely, because of the sheer scale of space, ever to be found by anybody or anything. It's merely a message to ourselves as to how we would encapsulate our vision of ourselves, our ideas about what we are, if ever we did find aliens out there in space. And it's a discovery which could happen tomorrow. It could not happen in ever. We do not know. But the thing is, the thing which Voyager's Golden Disk tells us quite plainly is that no human knows anything about aliens in space. Until it happens, until we find them, we won't be ready. But then again, when we find them, it may well be too late.
Sasha, just finally, I'd love to get your opinion on David's words there, particularly when he said that there's no evidence of life in the universe yet, because in your piece for The Spectator, you made, I think, the quite bold claim that you expect that there'll be a discovery of life on an exoplanet made during your lifetime. Why did you make that claim? And will it be James Webb to be the one to prove you right, do you think?
So it probably will not be the James Webb Space Telescope, but what we now know is that every 10 years, the United States astronomy community convenes sort of this blue ribbon panel to sort of address what are the big questions we need to address in the next 10 years. And they make recommendations to all the funding organizations in the United States, and this launches an international effort. This gave rise to the James Webb Space Telescope, the Hubble Space Telescope, et cetera, et cetera. So when this panel talks, people really listen. And their number one suggestion in the 2020 decadal survey came out a couple of years ago, was that we should try to do this project of the direct imaging for extrasolar planets to specifically search for Earth-like planets in the so-called habitable zones around their stars, the so-called Goldilocks zone that's not too hot, not too cold, perfect for having liquid water, we think is one of the necessary requirements for life. And this was the number one recommendation that from this committee that we should launch a mission in the first half of the 2040s to do a survey of maybe a couple dozen habitable zone planets to search for what we call biosignatures. So we may not discover evidence for life in my lifetime. All the evidence is there that we're going to build a mission in the first half of the 2040s that should be capable of doing that. And I find that terrifically exciting.
And that's it for this week. As ever, if you've enjoyed the podcast, why not pick up a copy of The Spectator magazine to read everything we talked about in full? I'm William Moore.
And I'm Lara Prendergast, and we hope you'll join us again next week.